All right. Hello and welcome again to another episode of Sacktown Talks. Today we have a special guest joining us. We have Senator Susan Rubio. Susan, how's it going? Thanks for joining the program.
Well, thank you for having me. I hope everyone listening is staying safe, and I'm happy to be here to share a little bit of what I'm doing. Thank you.
Yeah, you know, yesterday, I guess, was the big swearing in for everyone, you know, coming back to the Capitol. I guess, you know, how was it yesterday, I guess, being in the Senate chambers, kind of with your new colleagues and I guess the familiar faces and being back in Sacramento?
Well, first of all, it was a little nostalgic for me. I mean, it marks the second year, right? 2 years that I've been in office. But at the same time, I felt really sad for my colleagues. I remember the excitement around my swearing in, my parents being there, you know, just my family witnessing everything in a personal level. And this time they were asked to keep their families away. So it was a little sad moment for me just to see that they couldn't enjoy what I enjoyed 2 years ago.
You know, I guess it's kind of been a hectic time since you've been here in Sacramento, the 2 years. You know, last year was kind of a race. You know, not a lot of us have I guess, gotten to know you or your story. Can you kind of give us a little background on you and kind of your journey to Sacramento?
Yes, it's been quite a journey. But, well, first of all, you know, a lot of my drive really does come from my upbringing and some of my experiences. What your listeners need to know that, you know, as a young child growing up in Texas, I had been experiencing a lot of discrimination, but I didn't quite understand it. I was 4 years old, 5 years old, and it wasn't until my family was deported when I was four, going into 5 years old, that it hit me. I did not know I was undocumented. And even as I went to elementary school in Texas, I remember just vividly some of the discrimination I've experienced. For example, teachers would corner me and some of my siblings because they didn't know how to teach us. And I don't blame the teachers. I think back in the 70s, we didn't have enough programs to deal with second language learners, students that didn't speak the language. And so that was difficult. I remember always trying to participate and I couldn't. So going from a little bit of the discrimination I felt in class in Texas, going to being pulled out of school because we were deported, to having to come to California and experience a whole new world. These are some of the, you know, the moments in my life that sort of shaped where I was going to be in the future. And I think it's important that I tell this particular part of the story. People don't know that I'm a twin. And when we came from being deported, we were deported to Juarez, which is across the border from El Paso. We came to California, and in the 70s, to our detriment, students were tested based on their language deficiency. So they didn't recognize that a child just crossed the border. So if you didn't speak English, that didn't matter. So I just happened to be gifted. I know that as a teacher now, my twin wasn't as lucky. He was a fluent Spanish speaker. At the time, he was deemed mentally delayed because he didn't speak English. And to his detriment, once again, in the 70s, they wouldn't allow you to go to the same school. They would segregate you. So he went to a school with severely handicapped students. And so what happened, he went from being a very smart Spanish speaker to a non-speaker. He was mimicking all the behaviors in school that he saw. And so that just really was that moment, as young as I was, and I realize now that I've been fighting for all my life, and that is to help families like mine. At the time, my parents didn't speak English. They really couldn't help us. And of course, we didn't know any better. So that's where I became a teacher. I really remember just wanting to help at the time, and I couldn't. So I became a teacher. I've been a teacher for 17 years. I'm still a teacher on leave. And through those years, I was such a strong advocate for students, families, and everyone knew that I was a local council member. So naturally, they all started coming to me, asking me for housing, for food, for different things. And I think, you know, I continue to have that need to help others. When I was a council member, you could only do so much because resources are very limited and you don't have a lot of programs. So I always knew that if I had the opportunity to help families in a larger scale, then I would. And so the Senate became available, and that's how I ended up running for the seat and successfully won the seat. So that's a little bit of my story.
Oh, that's a tremendous story. I didn't even know that. And, you know, yes. I'm talking with your sister, and I, you know, I've even spent some time with your mother. You know, I've never heard that. That's astounding. You know, I guess when you guys came back to California, I guess what area did you guys live and kind of grow up?
Well, and this is a very popular area because it seems like that's where most of our immigrant families land. It's called Pico Union in downtown Los Angeles. And that's where I grew up until I was in my teens. I went to Belmont High School, which is, it was right in the heart of downtown Los Angeles, and Union Elementary School, which is, again, Pico Union. And it wasn't a very nice place to grow up. A lot of drugs, a lot of violence, a lot of our friends being shot, and, you know, just a lot of the things you don't want a little girl to witness. We just happened to see. But, you know, we say this, I think our upbringing and seeing such disparities, such injustices, a lot of gang, a lot of violence just made us so resilient that, you know, we were fighters, and it makes it very difficult to get knocked down and not step right back up because we've been through so many things in our lives, and we're thankful for the experience. And I think that we're thankful that that now makes us stronger legislators, and that we can relate to some of the families that we service so we can help them in a much personal way.
You know, that's an interesting point you kind of brought up about your twin. And, you know, kind of, you guys are the same age, you guys came from the same background, but, you know, received totally different treatment coming through the system. Kind of, I guess, you know, how's your twin doing now? And kind of, you know, was he able to overcome these issues, or, you know, is it something that he's still struggling with today?
Yeah. Well, thank you for asking. He's doing great. He's healthy. He has a job, but it really did get in the way of his success. And what I mean by that, he suffered significantly in terms of his self-esteem. He didn't quite recover. He couldn't compete with me. And, you know, and I feel a little guilty about this because, you know, we're twins, and I was not only ahead of him because I, you know, again, I spoke English a lot faster than he did, but now I know as a teacher myself, I was a gate student. So I was excelling in everything that I did. And he always found himself trying to catch up to me. At one point I was 2 years ahead of him. I skipped second grade. And so he just had such a hard time. As soon as he was old enough to make a decision, he dropped out of school and left California. He's lived in Kansas for about 30 years. And wow. So that's really, you know, it's been sad for us as a family, because I feel like, you know, Los Angeles Unified School District failed him. And because of that, I lost my close friend and ally. I mean, we're still very close, but, you know, we're in different states. It's very different when you're not around each other all the time.
No, definitely. And a lot of competition there from your sisters and siblings.
Yes.
Very well accomplished. You know, I guess that's something interesting is, you know, you and your sister and, you know, I guess your other sisters are very well accomplished, and kind of, you know, you just described your upbringing. You know, that, I guess, is that something that's unique that, you know, you guys were able to kind of overcome and kind of accomplish everything that you've done, kind of coming from, you know, your backgrounds and being, you know, Latina females and what you've been able to accomplish. Can you kind of, I guess, speak on that a bit?
You know, it's not necessarily unique, but, you know, when I look back at how we grew up, and believe me, we could have been shot any given day. There's so much that we witnessed that, again, we shouldn't be here where we're at. But when I think back, what was the difference? And, you know, thinking around what we saw, our friends and neighbors, you know, we had a blessing, and that's that we had a mom and dad. Till this day, my parents just celebrated 53 years anniversary this past month. And so when I think back of some of my neighbors and friends, they were, you know, we had single family households. And sometimes, you know, one of the things that my parents did well, and I have to thank them to this day, they didn't trust the system and they didn't trust strangers. So they never wanted us with babysitters. So they created a system among themselves where my mother would work the day shift. My father always worked the night shift. And so dad would get home, let's say at 6 a.m. And it was like a tag team. You know, he would hand, you know, mom would hand off, you know, the kids, and then dad would go to work, and it was like a rotation. And so I used to always tell my mother, and she'll say this joking, I say to her, what's your secret to a long marriage, mom? And she always says, we hardly saw each other. And she says this jokingly, but the one thing she always knew is that she needed to have one parent at home. They didn't trust the system. And I have to say, they didn't speak English. And all they ever said is, you're not playing unless you do your homework. And they were really strong advocates of education, and they and that's what we did. We make sure we went to school, we got a good education, and that was just a testament to their sacrifice and their hard work.
Right. You know, I guess kind of interesting, you coming up here to Sacramento, talk a little bit about, I guess, about your committee assignments. Kind of as the chairwoman of insurance, I guess, kind of where did your interest come from that, and kind of, you know, what's your background with insurance, and kind of why did you want to be chairwoman of that committee?
Well, and I'll be honest with you, it's not that I wanted to be the chairwoman of insurance, but that comes from my drive to better myself. When I had a sit down with the pro tem, and she asked me what I wanted, what was my interest, the one thing I did say to her, I said, I know typically we all gravitate to what we know. And I said, please don't put me on education, because I know education inside out. I want to challenge myself. I want to learn, you know, something that's not in my comfort zone. So whatever you're going to give me, make sure that I don't have, you know, a background in or full experience, because I really want to expand my knowledge of other areas. And so she, you know, she gave me share of insurance, and then she knows I work 24/7. I go deep Wow. into, you know, statistics, data. I consider myself, you know, a self-proclaimed nerd. I love factoids. I love research. And so it served me well. I've, you know, been able to work, you know, not only with some of the victims from like our current fires, and to try and find policies that help Californians, especially right now during this time with, you know, the wildfires and everything that's happening. So again, I didn't ask for it, but she was kind enough to give me something that would challenge my knowledge and really put me in a space where I could grow and learn as a person.
And so I guess your background in education, you know, are you using that at all, or are you seeking a, I guess, education policy, or, you know, have you kind of divested yourself from that?
And no. You know, education is in my blood. Like, it will never leave me. And so absolutely. Last year, I was able to champion about $10 million. I fought hard to invest $10 million in education to close the achievement gap, is particularly as it pertains to second language learners. And that comes from, again, knowing what happened to my brother. It also supports teachers. I remember when I started teaching, because I spoke Spanish, I always, you know, I was good at it. I was, I think in my personal opinion, the best teacher, because I had come from that background. But you know, teachers struggle with resources, so I wanted to help them. You know, right now, education again continues to be my focus. Right now, I'm working on making kindergarten mandatory. In California, a lot of people are surprised to know it's not mandatory.
Yeah, I didn't know that.
Yep, and that is, I know, people are shocked, but let me just give you a really quick example why I think it's so important. You know, I've done every single grade level. I was also assistant principal and principal at the time. So we have to do all grade levels. And when I was in first grade as a teacher, I had a student that came in. I had never been to school. And they're learning how to hold a pencil. They're learning how to hold a book. And sometimes they haven't even seen a book. And then they're sitting next to a child who's writing full sentences, who are fluent and are reading at a second grade level. And then they're talking about these experiments they did over summer camp. And you start seeing why it's absolutely necessary to have mandatory kindergarten, because by the time they get to first grade, there's already a 2-year gap between their education, right? And I know as a teacher that the gap only grows exponentially. If you don't capture kids, or students rather, in third grade, by the time they get to fourth grade, we've lost them. That, you know, K to third grade, that's when you learn the fundamentals of reading and writing. And so right now that's my focus, trying to make sure that kindergarten is mandatory. So no, I have not divested. I'm still very much involved in education.
Yeah, that's something common we hear about the importance of early childhood education. I guess what age is it appropriate, kind of universal TK, you know, to begin this and kind of, you know, I guess begin the education process?
So right now I'm collaborating with a few senators and a few assembly members to create a package, because sometimes we find that pieces sometimes don't work, and we're hoping to create a full package this year that we can move forward, especially we know the governor has made that a priority. And so right now I'm co-authoring several bills along with other other senators and assembly members, and that is, as I share with you, mandatory kindergarten. The other one is expanding transitional kindergarten, because sometimes children get caught in between ages. So for example, if your birthday is after a certain month, they won't accept you. You have to wait until the following year. And so expanding transitional kindergarten, where these children that don't qualify for kinder can go and start early, that's important. We're talking about also, funding support for parents from 0 to 5 to make sure that everyone has the same opportunity. So it's a whole package. It's still early in the working group. We had a press conference this morning about it. It was led by Assemblymember McCarty. And so we're hopeful that we can push this entire package that's going to be very comprehensive. And hopefully we can help capture some of the students that are currently falling behind because of COVID, issues, whether it's technology or maybe they don't have the support system at home. I know for a fact as a teacher that even during summer, our students go back up to 2 months if they are not consistently reading over the summer to prepare for the following year. Some of our students have been out practically 3, 4, 5 months, depending on the household. And so this is when it matters. We need to make sure that early childhood education is in place, that we have programs for these students that are gonna need some kind of support in terms of tutoring and trying to get them caught up to where they need to be. So yeah, that is one of our biggest focuses this year.
And I guess, you know, this is kind of the season where everyone's coming up with their new bill ideas up until February. Yeah. Kind of what are some of the other issues you're looking to tackle here coming into 2021?
Well, I really have my hand in a lot of things. And so I just kind of want to go backwards a little too. When I came to the Senate, I think it's well known, I'm a survivor of domestic violence. So I did say, you know, I was going to tackle some policies that are going to strengthen support systems for victims. And so the first year I passed the Phoenix Act, which would extend the statute of limitation to victims. Typically here in California, victims had up to 3 years to really go to therapy and find their courage to speak up and bring their abusers to justice. And so 2019, I was able to extend that to 5 years. So we gave them 2 extra years to be able to do so. I also passed SB 1141 last year, which is, you know, just, it's really monumental in that it's never been done before. We were able to extend this, the definition of domestic violence, to include coercive control. I think people always think that abuse means a bruise in your arm, a black eye. Even when you go to court, judges expect you to show your evidence in terms of the black eye and the bruise or broken bones. But I think what people fail to understand is that abuse, the physical assault, happens after years and years of manipulation. And I talk to victims, and I have talked to so many throughout this journey. They talk about, their significant others, intimate partners, locking them up, not allowing them to see their families or friends. They take their finances away so they don't have a support system. One victim shared that the intimate partner ruined her credit because she wanted to leave, and he knew that she couldn't get an apartment if she didn't have good credit. So they use all these tactics that really basically entrap victims in a situation that they don't want to be in. And so now, based on my bill that passed last year, and it'll become law in January, victims can now take coercive control as supporting evidence to court and bring their abusers to justice, not just on the physical assaults, but also all the manipulation that happened throughout the years. And so that's something that I'm very proud of.
Very interesting. You know, last year, you know, the legislation, you know, was curtailed due to COVID-19. Are you expecting any sorts of kind of curtailment of potential bills you can do, this session? Or do you think, you know, it's going to be back to where you have a wide variety of items? Or is COVID-19 going to be more of the focus again this session?
Well, last session, it was something new. You know, we didn't know where we were headed. I just know that when March hit and they were asking us to stay home, we didn't understand COVID-19. We didn't understand the impacts of it. But nonetheless, we shut down. We were you know, home for about 2 months, and that really hindered our ability to move so many of the policies forward. Now that we've kind of learned what COVID-19 is, and we've learned to be safe, and we have so many safety guards here in place in the Capitol, that I think we're going to be doing a little bit more, but I think we can't be too ambitious because, you know, that we still have to present these bills in committees. Last year, we were successful because instead of double referring bills to two committees, which is typical, you know, if they have two different committees, we streamlined it and bills were only presented in one committee. This year, if we try to do both committees again, it might be a challenge. So I, you know, it's very preliminary. We don't know where we're going to be in January, but I'm trying to be hopeful, but I'm trying to not be overly ambitious. I want to just focus on what I really want to get done. Just in case they ask us to streamline our bills, by way of example, last year, everyone had the average of, I'm going to say 25 to 35 bills, and all of us were asked to tailor down our package to 5 or 10 bills, and that's the average. Some members had 0 bills. They went from, you know, 35 to 0, and I think the most someone had was like 9 bills, at least in the Senate. So it was a big, it was just so different than what we're used to every session. But this year, we want to get what's really essential through.
Well, Senator, I know you're on a time crunch, so we want to let you go. But one last question here, you know, since you're on a special edition of Sactown Talks, the holiday episode. We want to know kind of what's your favorite, you know, holiday song?
Okay. My favorite holiday is Christmas because it's also my birthday. Yes, I'm a Christmas baby. And a twin at that, right? Two little ones born on the same day on Christmas.
Christmas miracle.
And so in general, I love everything that Christmas entails, every song, anything that has to do with Christmas. It's always been my favorite holiday.
Well, good to know. Well, happy birthday coming up. I hope you get a lot of presents.
Thank
and I hope you're a good girl.
Thank you. It's been an honor. Thank you for having me here and allowing me to share my story. Really appreciate it.
All right. We'd love to have you on again to talk about in more detail some of the things you're working on next year. So
absolutely. Absolutely.
Have a happy birthday. Thank you so much. Merry Christmas. And we'll talk to you next year.
You too. Happy holidays to everyone listening. Thank you.
Okay. All right, you got it. All right. Thanks, Edward.
Thank you. All right. Enjoy.
All right, great.
Thank you. Bye.
All right. Thanks, Edward. Some are called dreamers. Wow.